Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Bullseye Saints Hour. I'm Mike Austin. We're joined by Kai Harley, the Senior Vice President of Football Operations, Assistant General Manager, a promotion he got back in 2024. You arrived in 2008.
Correct.
Good timing. Good timing.
I think so.
Yeah, worked out pretty well. Second year.
For everybody.
Win the Super Bowl. I always call this class in session because I learn more in this time with you. And then I leave and I forget it all because I'm like, I don't know. it's so, it can be complicated. But from a day-to-day football operation, because you're in charge of a lot of all the football operations day to day. Give me a sense of today's Tuesday, and so the players are off. What's a Tuesday look like for you?
Look, a typical Tuesday is going over with Mickey, Michael, and the coaches where we're at from a roster standpoint, getting ready for the practice week. Obviously, yesterday we would have gone over the advance for the upcoming opponent. So now we're looking at, hey, what are our practice needs, communicating with our training staff, who's available, who do we think is going to be available, you know, not only for practice but for the game on Sunday. And obviously that's a fluid process. You know, day to day you can have injuries that crop up, but you're prospecting, you know, where you think the roster is going to be at and if you need to make any changes, you know, either by workout today or assigning for tomorrow. And then this afternoon we'll have some meetings to further go over some, you know, keys to what we need to win the game for the upcoming weekend.
When you arrived and you'd spent some time with the NFL and you did scouting and internship, you've done a little bit of everything, but has your job evolved from, I don't want to say pure numbers, but has it evolved more into player evaluation, actual player evaluation, or has that always been an aspect?
I would say I've been very fortunate in my time here in you know, what Mickey has allowed me to participate in that really I've been involved in all aspects of what we do since the moment I got here. So, you know, even with a primary focus on cap and numbers, there's still a personnel component to that. There's still a scouting and evaluation component to that. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do those things over the course of my career here.
But a lot of it is CBA compliance, correct?
I mean, look, I think everybody in the building has a focus for their particular job, but we also are a all hands on deck, you know, group. So all of us get exposure to different areas, but yet we all have responsibilities. So while I will, you know, manage our cap and negotiate our player contracts, you know, there's a number of other responsibilities when it comes to our operations that I have to keep track of and be on top of. And then from a personnel evaluation standpoint, you're never really going to be really good at knowing how much and who to pay if you're not evaluating the talent as well, if you're not scouting the talent as well.
So if you're looking at your player evaluation, is it any different than Mike Parenton's, or are you looking at this guy even from a draft situation, because you're involved with draft and the college and the pro personnel going, and I'll use draft as an example. Well, he's a junior. He's making $3 mil NIL money. Maybe he's not as draftable as this guy, or are you looking at this right guard is a better fit for us? You know, is it more of the what I said? Yeah. You know,
I'm going to say, look, I'm not going to look at NIL, and you know, when you look at the NIL space and what these players are coming in making, I think more often than not, that might be some insight into how the player deals with money. You know, from a character personality standpoint, than it is the actual talent of the player. But when it comes to the overall evaluation, I'm more looking at what's the overall fit on the roster. But also, I think a primary consideration is what are our alternatives, right? So whether you're, you know, obviously the draft comes after free agency. So as you're going into free agency, and just for argument's sake, say you're looking at a tackle, right? And there are several tackles available. And there's going to be a price point that each one of those tackles are available for, or that you think they're going to be available for. Well, an additional aspect of the evaluation is, well, how many guys are available in the draft? And at what positions, you know, are they going to be available in the draft? And what draft picks do we have? So does it behoove us to spend that money on a free agent if there's an adequate player available in the early part of the draft where we have draft capital?
Tough when injuries happen, and they do. You could have five guys injured and a wide out, a tight end, a DB, and you make that work pretty simply. When it's Will Clapp, Landon Young, Nick Saldivari, Barry Wesley, you know, when it's at a position, it's extremely challenging. And I don't remember, and I'm sadly old, a year where there have been so many trades. But it just feels like, hey, in years past, maybe there's a guy we can pick up, throw on our practice squad, develop him. You've not had that luxury this year. You've had to go out and get guys through the trade and who have been on the field literally with weeks of training. That's been the difference, really.
I don't know if I would go all the way there. Each year is going to present different circumstances. Certainly, you know, we've had years where you know, we've been maybe top heavy and haven't had the need, and we've been healthier and haven't had the need to go out there and acquire players. But I would say in a general sense, we're always looking for opportunities to improve the team, whether we're healthy or not. And it just so happens that this year, you know, there's been some health issues at certain spots, but there's also been opportunities that have presented themselves to help us both now and in the future that we've wanted to take advantage of. But, you know, you go back a number of years and, you know, we traded for a long snapper right before the regular season started and needed to play, or we traded for an offensive lineman that needed to play. You know, it's varied from year to year. But I think ultimately what you always want to have focus on is, you know, when an opportunity presents itself, are you in a position to take advantage of that opportunity? And does the player that you have the opportunity to acquire, does he fit you both in the short term and the long term? And do you have a vision for how that player is going to contribute? It takes two to tango. And obviously there's a, you know, typically an offer, counter offer, and these things go back and forth. And it's, you know, what are they willing to give up a player for, and what are we willing to give up to acquire a player?
When we come back on the Bullseye Saints Hour, we'll continue our inside look of the black and gold. Bullseye, the official tailgate of the New Orleans Saints, and more with Senior Vice President of Football Operations and Assistant General Manager Kai Harley when we come back here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Bullseye Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Kai Harley, Senior Vice President of Football Operations. During the draft, I don't know if it's still viable. There's a draft chart. You know, hey, this guy, if you want to make a trade in the fourth round, he's worth, and you go over the line. Is there anything like that for trades, or is it just mano a mano?
You're talking about just like the player
is
for
player something, trade? Is there some type of chart that says, hey, you're going to give a seventh round, you need to get X in return?
It's hard to answer that question. I would say there's not a specific chart that applies to a particular player. You know, the charts that you hear about, the charts that you see, more so relate to the draft itself. So you know, from a qualitative standpoint, have to decide if you're trading that for a particular veteran player, is what do you think that player's worth? And relate that back to the chart, and you'll use historical context for that, for some of that, and that'll be what have players of this ilk typically gotten in the past, you know, whether you go back 5 years, 10 years, or whatever, you just see how many have been out there. But ultimately, it's like, if you want the player and that team is looking to trade the player, and it's like, hey, what's the deal that everybody's happy with? And then you figure out whether or not you can make it happen.
Spent 5 years as manager of labor of relations with the NFL, then also with the management council. Then 2002, you were with the league office. And so you've kind of seen it from both sides. Roger Goodell says that the 18-game schedule won't be on the table until talks begin for the CBA, which it's, I think, 2031.
Officially.
2030, which makes it an 11-year, right? But talks could begin in 2028, right? I mean, who's to say, I guess, taking, this is not about necessarily a Saints question, but you feel like the 18-game is not a question of when or if, it's a question of when. Will it happen prior to the CBA, do you think?
I mean, look, from our vantage point, it's hard to say. You know, there's definitely a lot of talk, and when there's a lot of smoke, there's usually a fire somewhere. So I would say that it appears that that's the direction that folks want to go. But you also have to consider that the NFLPA is establishing new leadership over there. So that's going to at least put a pause on some of those potential talks. But CBA negotiations can happen at any time that, you know, both parties are willing to talk. So, you know, we're not always privy to the exact details of that. But there's various committees across the league that continuously put data together to drive those talks. So, you know, we'll find out when we need to find out.
Part of the NFL Diversity Council, how's the NFL doing overall? In that aspect, I guess, you know, whether you look at general managers or head coaches, that's two of the positions that get judged the most.
I mean, look, that's a very subjective question. I would say, obviously, some strides have been made, you know, over the course of history, and yet there's still work to be done.
When these guys come in, they're 18, 19, 20, now they're 22, 23, 24 because of the COVID and NIL. Who's guiding? Is it the NFL? Who's guiding them?
Well, look, players have opportunity to have exposure to money management at a variety of different levels. Now, obviously, when it comes to NIL, that's outside of our wheelhouse. That's not our space. So what I would say is, as we move forward, there should be conceptually more players that come into our league who are more financially literate than maybe they were 10, 15 years ago, because the colleges are now providing a little bit more guidance on that level than maybe what they've done.
Do you feel they come in now a little more
I would say on average, yes. And again, coming from a finance background, I think it's all in the individual and what they take of the exposure that they have to those areas. Some guys take it a little bit more seriously than others. But I would say is everybody, you know, can use some guidance and can use some assistance when it comes to managing their finances, myself included. Also, I would say there's more exposure to the pitfalls of not being financially literate. There's probably more trap doors than what there were.
Right.
15, 20 years ago.
I know the NFL does rookie camps, and
we have financial literacy training, and right. You know, our VP of player engagement, Fred McAfee, will do a lot with the players, you know, on that. You know, I'll have some outside conversations with some players, but again, I think you're finding more guys are coming into the league a little more financially literate, certainly more financially prepared. And yet they still don't have, you know, the level of compensation that they will receive if they become good players in our league. So, and that's still something that people have to, you know, understand if they're going to manage it correctly and be able to live the rest of their lives off of the money that they've earned.
You have been always a bit of a trailblazer, really, from a diversity standpoint. Financial analyst at Bloomberg. Who was your mentor? Because as you trans evolve into the football world, who was that guy?
Look, I've been very fortunate and lucky in some instances to be exposed to as many people as I've been exposed to earlier in my career. My first internship in Indianapolis with the Colts, I, you know, was exposed to Bill Polian, Bob Turpining, who, you know, had long careers in this league, successful careers in this league, went to Philadelphia with the Eagles thereafter, and was able to work with Joe Banner and Howie Roseman, who have both done a lot of good things in this league. You know, went to the league office under Joel Bussard and Ken Fiore, who have done a lot of things in this league. Moved over to labor operations, worked for Peter Rugo and Ed Tai, who have worked tirelessly for a number of years in this league and accomplished a bunch of different things. Was able to participate in several programs within the league, whether it was Peter Had Hazy, who had a long USFL career, then became a executive in the league office. Art Shell, who everybody knows, had him as a mentor early in my career. Ray Anderson, who had been a longtime executive in the league, eventually went to Arizona State as their athletic director there. And then to come here and have, Mickey Loomis, one of the winningest general managers in league history, and, Sean Payton early on, one of the better coaches in this league. I've been very, very blessed to be around a number of very good people, and I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two people.
I think you did pretty well. There's certainly more than one. So take a quick break. Again, this is the Bullseye Saints Hour. We're with Kai Harley, Senior Vice President of Football Operations. Back after this on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Well, welcome back to the Bullseye Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Kai Harley, Senior Vice President of Football Operations, been with this team since 2008 and just really an evolution. But you talk about an evolution, I want to talk about a couple of things. And obviously, you know, you're the cap guru and all. And we don't say that as much more. I think which is good, because I think there has been an evolution from a player personnel situation. So in 2000, now we just had the TV contract in 98, and so it was the 26% jump in the cap. So in 2000, when you were in labor relations, but in 2002, when you started with the league office, the cap was $71 million. Typically, the cap will raise between 6 and 9% a year, unless you get a CBA or TV. And TV has changed things significantly. 14% in 2022, 12.6% in 2024. So I don't get it wrong. What's the cap right now?
It's 279.2.
And where are the Saints in that cap situation?
We're about $9.5 million under.
Under. You've had more, it feels like, more money. You did your magic in the spring, like you always do. Go on, go, God, do your magic. We're 70 over, and you got to get us under. But more money to spend, even active roster spots, it feels like that this season, I don't want to say your hands haven't been tied, but you've had more flexibility, it feels like. Is that accurate?
I wouldn't necessarily go there. I think from the outside world, they might perceive that to be the case. When you go year to year and people see, in February and March, the work that you have to do to get under, they perceive that the sky is falling. and I would say it's just a way in which that we've gone about processing our contracts and managing our cap, where we utilize the money when we need it. We utilize the space when we need it. So, I don't know that we've ever been in a position where we couldn't do something that we wanted to do, where the cap prevented us from right. doing something that we needed to do. So that's where I would differ with that, assessment. But certainly I think we have, we started the off season with more room and have a little bit more room now than maybe what we've had in some years past. But, these things become cyclical over the years. So
I think you were roughly around 70 over at the start. I know you hear it, and I'm curious as to how you react to the statement, because it is said 100 times in the offseason that the Saints are simply kicking the can down the road and eventually are going to have to pay the piper. How does that, one, do you feel that's accurate? And two, how does it make you feel?
I don't necessarily think it's accurate. I think there's a way that we go about managing our team, and I don't think you can divorce, the cap from, our roster and our talent. And what I would say is, over the last 18 years that I've been here, I would say that we have, either the fifth or sixth most regular season wins in that time period. And I think for folks that say cap hell, I would say that's a strange definition of hell, that level of success, that level of prosperity. And look, it goes without saying, the last few years we haven't accomplished the things that we've want to accomplish, and nobody's more disappointed than we are in that. But we're working hard every day to try and turn that around. But, ultimately what I would say is that, we benefit from ownership on down, and that, we're trying to overturn, turn over every stone in the pursuit of winning. And we're not going to, limit resources in the pursuit of that.
If I had told you in 2002 with the cap at $71 million that in 2025 it's going to be $200 million more, would you have believed me? Or could you?
I don't know that anybody necessarily looks 20 years in the future to say, where it's going.
But
like,
at that point,
you know it's going to grow.
If you did the 4%, 6%, you'd go, well, there's no way. There's got to be. But the TV streaming deals and, bringing them into the picture changed.
Yeah,
picture.
I mean, look, television becomes the largest driver of our revenue as a league, and we've been the biggest thing on television for years. So, certainly we've put out a competitive product as a league, and that's what drives everything that we do. So we're certainly fortunate from that aspect. But still in all, when you look at, even you go before then and you go to the advent of the CBA and, you had of the current structure as we know it in 93, 94. And you say, minimum salaries were, $50,000-$60,000 then. And to go from there and say minimum salary for a first year guy is $840,000 is, that's a pretty big jump. And when you look at the rest of the country and you look at inflation and everything else that affects the rest of the country, that's a pretty big jump, So, again, I don't know that you can necessarily, you project prosperity and you know that you have something good and you know it's going to grow. But to what extent, you know, when you got new stadiums coming online and all of the things that go into the calculation of the split that we have between ownership and players, you know, because there's a lot more to player cost than simply the cap. Right. So there's benefits and certain other things that go into it as well. So and that's negotiated, you know, every time with the NFLPA. So how much is going into the cap? How much is going into additional benefits? You know, that's the silent part that nobody talks about. But all of this, you know, everybody's been able to benefit by the growth of the league. And again, I think it's eye opening. You know, and it's a credit to a lot of the work that everybody's done at every level, from players all the way up to ownership, that everybody works hard to put out a good product, and we've reaped the rewards of that.
Family man?
Yes.
Three
girls.
Three girls. What are their ages?
20, 18, and 15.
And we talk about this every April because of the Saints Draft Room, Autism Awareness Month, and it should be Autism Awareness Year. Because I know it's very important to you, Culture City that the Saints have and the Pelicans, and I would assume, I know the Eagles are a big part of it, and really all the stadiums I think have really gotten on board.
Most stadiums have something,
right?
Every organization is different in terms of what additional programs or resources they have. Jeffrey Lurie has a brother that's on the spectrum, so they've had a foundation for a very long time that does a lot of great things. And, you know, there are some other folks around the league that are just trying to bring more awareness to what's going on, just like I am. So it's just a credit to all those people.
Class is over. It's early in the season. Continued, you know, keep working hard, nose to the grindstone like I know you will. A lot of football left to play. And as always, I appreciate the information because it is a learning experience.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Bullseye Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Chris Rumpf II, number 58, changed your number. You and Jonathan Bullard kind of mixed me up a little bit early on, but it's all right. Where's home originally?
Home is South Carolina. It's actually funny you brought up the number. My dad wore 58 in college, so that's a little tribute to him. Shout out, Pops. But yeah, I'm from South Carolina born, and then obviously my dad was a coach, so I moved all over the place. You can't name a state in the South that I didn't live in, except I didn't live in Georgia and Mississippi. Those are two ones I didn't live in.
Didn't live in?
Didn't live in.
Those would have been my first two choices that you probably lived in.
A lot of people assume Georgia, too. Oh, no, I mean, South Carolina, Texas, Tennessee, Florida, Alabama, South Carolina.
What part of South Carolina?
I lived in Clemson, but my dad's from St. Matthew's. My mom is from Darlington.
Okay.
Yeah. So South Carolina's in my blood.
How did you end up at Duke?
I took a junior day visit there, and I loved it. And I kind of committed there really early in my recruiting process. But once I got there and, you know, I prayed about it, I just felt like that was just the place that God led me to be. And obviously they weren't, you know, known for football at the time. But I think the class that I had going in with the guys, you know, we went on official visits. We felt like we could change, you know, the culture around there. And so that kind of what, you know, drove me to Duke was just, you know, a challenge to kind of put them on the map and put a stamp on my time there.
So I'm from Virginia. So I grew up. Now, wait a minute.
I hate Virginia and Virginia
no,
Tech.
Come on. We're good.
Okay, we're good?
Virginia Tech.
Okay, but we're good.
We're good. I went to James Madison.
All right, then we're good. No issues. No issues.
UVA, Virginia Tech, man, they were our arch rivals. They were our arch rivals.
We got some in common.
So, yeah. To Raleigh and that whole area and Duke. And I remember the first time I saw Cameron at Indoor Stadium and I went, what? That's it? Mm-hmm. That's the place I've been watching? It looks like a small theater on Magazine Street that you would walk by 100 times.
Yeah, you would never think, especially with the hype and how big the games have been played there, that it's that small. Or in the middle of campus, right next to the football field, and you look at it,
you're like, I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. Then you go to the Dean Smith Center, well, this I get.
Yeah, but in Duke fashion, man, the stadium's right next to the academic facility. So, that's a cool vintage old school stadium, and a lot of big games have been played there. So I've been lucky to go to two games.
Your time with Brandon Staley, tell me about it. And kind of, you know, we've heard so much about Brandon, but it's all been the same. I don't think I've ever had a coach come in new or talk to a complete defensive unit, and they all say the same thing. Oh, he's a blast to play for. He's fun. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And usually it's the defensive ends who feel like they have a new flexibility. They're not necessarily tied. It's not that you don't have a playbook. You're not necessarily tied to it. It's play by gut, play by instinct. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
Yeah, 100%. You look at the college world right now. I mean, the edge guys are the ones that you can change a game at any play. And so to be in a system where the coaches recognize that and allow us to play aggressive and fast within the system, that's everything you ask for. As an edge rusher, I mean, our whole job is to affect the quarterback and disrupt plays. And so to be able to have a defense to where you're just getting off the ball, and especially if you do your job as a professional and study, watch film, you can take shots and make plays. And so, I mean, it's a blast to play in this defense, especially as an edge guy.
See how I kind of waited to get this question in? This is not the start that you guys wanted. It doesn't matter how it happened. It felt like Arizona, San Francisco trending right direction. Seattle's, I feel like just an aberration. I mean, in special teams, I mean, you know, with that kind of, you get down that fast, your head's spinning.
Yeah.
Tell me your thoughts about the progression of this team.
No, definitely. You mentioned it. I mean, the first two games, against some quality opponents. I mean, they got playmakers of San Fran and Arizona. Both got playmakers at running back and receiver, quarterback. And we played those guys tight. Obviously, we got to stop shooting ourselves in the foot with the penalties. But we were tight within those games. We had a shot, and we didn't knock them down. But, yeah, last week was, like you said, an anomaly. And sometimes you go through that in the league. You go back to last year, you look at a lot of teams who were 0-3 who made the playoffs. And a lot of teams that were 3-0 didn't. And so what you got to do as an organization, as a team, is just kind of sit back, kind of understand that, okay, let's just flush that. That's not us. We shot ourselves in the foot. Let's be honest, we got outplayed. And you just go back to the drawing board. You go back to work. And that's what the mindset is with this team, is that this week we have to have a great Wednesday. It starts right there. We have to have great walkthroughs. We have to have great sessions in the film room, and then just continue to stack those days, and then come back this week and play a good Buffalo team in Buffalo.
Yeah, it doesn't get any easier, right?
No.
I mean, for yourself, I don't think people understand when you started playing again this year. I can't remember. It was the end of the 23 season, probably the January 24 game, but your last game prior to suiting up against Arizona would have been the 23 season, right? Your foot injury hit you out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's there's some rust to get knocked off,
yeah,
correct?
Especially preseason, you're not going against the starters. And so for me, golly, man, it's been a long road. But, yeah, 23 was the last game. Detroit, I hurt my game. Oh, actually, New York. New York Jakes, week 6 or 7, 23 was my last official regular season game.
Wow, okay, so I was wrong.
Yeah. It's been a while.
I guess certainly there's an excitement of getting back, but there's also, you know, you got to get, there's shape and football shape. Yeah. And preseason gets you somewhat there, but not all the way there, right?
No. I think after that Arizona game, for me, because especially when I hurt my foot in 23, that's when, for me, it started to click. And you always talk, you always hear about guys when the flip switches, when they get in the league, and everybody has their own process. Some guys, it happens as soon as they get there. Some guys, it takes a little long. For me, it took a little bit longer. But once I was getting in a good groove and finally, like, okay, it doesn't matter who's in front of me. I know I can win. Foot injury happens. And so to come back and then play in the first regular season game since 23 against Arizona, definitely that was a knockoff the rust type of game. I go back and watch that film. I was disappointed. And then, you know, I was blessed for the opportunity to, you know, make a play in the next game. And I just felt like, okay, I'm all right. We're back on track, back on where we left off. And now I'm just trying to get off and make plays for this team.
Tell me about that play. That was the strip sack,
yeah,
of Mac Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about the back end. But tell me from your perspective on that play.
I mean, from my perspective, that's what I'm supposed to do. Everybody keeps hyping that play up. I'm sick of it, honestly, because that shouldn't be a shock that I made that play. That's something that you should expect from every time I go on the field. But
I think part of that is until Sunday, it was the only turnover.
Yeah,
it was the only turnover we could talk about. It wasn't a great play.
Yeah.
But it was the only one we could talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I get that. But yeah, I mean, going through that play, I mean, it was just the guy off the ball. You know, obviously I fell down, but you know, just high effort play, and that's what most of these sacks in the league are, is just effort plays. And got off. I saw Mac Jones still holding the ball. I'm like, okay, I got a shot. Let me go ahead, stick my arm out, and I felt that ball go up. And the next thing you know, I'm just like, please somebody pick it up. Just somebody pick it up from our team. And I saw DeMar. Well, I didn't see DeMar because I ran to the sideline. And I saw him going to celebrate. And I'm like, it's been a while. I forgot, you know, guys got to celebrate at the end zone now.
Right.
So that was another thing I had to knock off. But, yeah, that was a play to kind of keep us in the game. And I'm just, you know, glad I was able to do my job and do something positive for this team.
Not everybody in the stands knows it because I didn't, mm-hmm. but you knew automatically it was a fumble. They were going to review it. You knew, but you knew.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing that goes back to practice is you drill the things that translate to the game. And that's the things that the fans don't see is us drilling that exact reach every day in practice. And then that way, when we do get an opportunity, like I'm telling you, it's not like I thought about doing it. It's kind of my body just reacted. That's what I was trained to do in that situation. And so that's kind of cool to just see all that kind of work that you put in through training camp and practice come out and you see it on the game field.
We will have more with defensive end Chris Rumpf II when we come back. This is the Bullseye Saints Hour. Bullseye, the official tailgate of the New Orleans Saints, here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back. It is the Bullseye Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Chris Rumpf II, defensive end, and we were talking about his strip sack against San Francisco, and I commented during the broadcast just because I thought it was a phenomenal play for DeMario, because he didn't – ball's out there. I mean, he didn't try to pick it up,
no.
Didn't scoop it. It was, man, he fought hard for that football.
Yeah. Hey, shout out DeMario, man. Appreciate you. It's funny because he was the first guy that came and he handed me the ball. And so that was a pretty cool moment. And for a guy of his caliber who's been doing it at a highest level for so long, I mean, it was an honor, man. It was one of the things I won't forget, be able to tell my kids one day. But yeah, man, that was be able to good and celebrate. And I told him I was going to make a play for him. So that was just a good team ball. And on the other hand, a lot of people don't realize is the guys on the back end. I'm not getting the opportunity. I fell down. You don't get the opportunity of falling down and getting back up without, you know, we got the secondary strapping the receivers on the back end. So as much credit as I get, it wouldn't have been possible without those guys. So shout out Saints secondary, man.
Yeah, you haven't had a chance. You have in practice with Chase's calf, but mm-hmm. to be – Cam Jordan, Carl Granderson, Chase Young, I mean, and DeMario Davis, really Cam and DeMario, 36 years old.
Yeah.
They defy age,
yeah.
Both of them.
Those guys have gold jackets waiting for them.
Defensively, when you look at maybe San Francisco, it's hard to really look at Seattle, but the ability for the front four, front three, however you want to look at it, to get some pressure on the quarterback without having to send a safety, without having to send a linebacker is so crucial, because that's, I mean, when you can do that, you're dictating to them.
That, we saw the Super Bowl last year. I mean, they rushed four guys and they had nothing for them offensively. And so when you can do that, it changes games. And I think we definitely have the front to be able to do that.
Played in Buffalo before?
Never played in Buffalo before. Never played Buffalo, actually. Yeah. So it'll be a fun one. It'll be a first for me. I'm excited. Obviously, I love playing any team that is, you know, up there. You know, they're up there. They went to playoffs last year. Went to playoffs, beat Baltimore last year. So anytime to go and play against a Super Bowl contender team, you love that opportunity, because you get to go prove to the world, hey, we're right there with them.
First year in New Orleans, fifth year in the league. Well, you're... Initial thoughts about this town that we have here.
Oh, I love it, man. Goodness gracious, such a refresher. I mean, I'm not going to say my time in L.A. was hated, but the fans down here, they're different. I forgot how big football is in the South, and I love it because I'm from here.
Yeah.
And so it's just refreshing to know that you got fans supporting you no matter what. And we have the best fans in the world. I mean, especially for the things that, you know, Katrina, and we saw that documentary come out not too long ago, and obviously I wasn't here to experience it, but after watching that and to see how much the team means to the city, I don't think any other team in the league has the same amount of responsibility for the city to do what they're supposed to do, and that's win. And I think you... Once I got here, I kind of understood how important it is to the fans. You feel more, not pressure, responsibility. Just you want to do it more. It's something, you're fighting, you're playing for something other than what you are already playing for. A lot of guys play for their families, kids, you know, God. But with all that, you also have the fans, the people. And the more that I'm down here, the more genuine, the more love there is in the city. And the more you want to win for the city.
Kind of, what coach was your dad? What position? D-line
coach. D-line, yeah.
So that must have been a lot of fun, right?
I didn't play football until my sophomore year in high school. So a lot of people would think, you know, being a coach's dad, coach's son, that I would have been playing football. No, he wasn't like that. He wanted my body to develop. He wanted me to play other sports and have those traits. And then once I found love for the game myself, that's when... He let me play in high school. So,
basketball
and baseball are my sports. Yeah,
he wasn't one of those dad coaches that we kind of.
Oh no, I wasn't playing football, but whatever I was doing, he was making sure I was you know, putting my 110%. I remember I was playing basketball. He forced me to go dribble around the whole neighborhood with my right hand and my left hand. So I still got coach now. Don't get it twisted. I was up there, whatever team he was at, I was up there early mornings with the team, working out, doing all that stuff. And it definitely, I had an opportunity to be a, because he was at Alabama. He's been in some successful programs. I've seen what it looks like to what it takes to be successful. And so I've been blessed with the opportunity to kind of gauge that and know, okay, this is where we're lacking, and this is what we're doing good. And so, yeah, it was pretty cool being a coach's kid.
Last question. What's the best thing you've had to eat since you got here? I know you haven't been here that long, but...
Golly, man. I'm a big beignet guy. I love beignets. I'm going to go with Café Du Monde. That's my thing. I love beignets. It's my favorite sweet. And to be able to just go down the street and get the originals, I mean, you can't beat that.
Also, hard to find anything more messy.
Yeah,
it's amazing where
don't
you
wear
can't
black.
Hide it.
Yeah.
You can't go and go, did you have beignets? No, man, what are you talking about?
As dust is coming out your mouth.
Your car looks like. So it's hard.
Yeah, you're not hiding them beignets, man.
Trust me when I say, you haven't seen the best of the Saints fans. It's coming, right? They are a unique fan base, and it is coming, and they will support you win or lose. But when you're winning, baby, that place is. It impacts.
Thank you very much for being on the show.
That is our show for tonight. Thanks for listening. My thanks to Kai Harley, Chris Rumpf II, Charlie Long back in the booth. And after a trip to the Pacific Northwest, we will go to the Upper Northeast and Buffalo, New York, Sunday at noon. A big one for sure. Hope to see you next week for the Bullseye Saints Hour here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.